This is July the 7th, 2005. This is an SEC Historical Society oral history interview of former chief accountant A. Clarence Sampson. Morning, Clarence.
Good morning, Ernie. How are you today?
Good. Why don't we start at the beginning, Clarence? Where did you grow up?
I grew up just outside of Washington, D.C., in a small county, or not a small county, in Maryland, Prince George's County.
Where did you go to school?
The usual, might as well be no-name elementary and high schools, and University of Maryland is where I got my higher education.
And you graduated from Maryland with a degree in what?
Degree in, what did they call it? Business administration with a major in accounting.
Okay, what did you do when you left school?
I had been in advanced ROTC, so I was a second lieutenant in the Army, and after a few months with a small CPA, I went in the Army, Air Force, as an auditor, and spent my time in Germany on an airbase.
What did you do after your Air Force service?
Came back to Maryland and then went to work in Washington, D.C. with the office of Arthur Young and Company, which had just opened. As a matter of fact, I started the day they opened the office and was a staff auditor there for 2 years.
And then?
Then I went to a small division of Litton Industries in College Park, Maryland, and stayed there for almost 2 years. After which, I went to a meeting at the NAA one night where Andy Barr stood up in the audience and said, "I need accountants at the SEC." And it sounded interesting, so I thought, I've had 2 years in industry and 2 years in auditing. I'll try the government for a couple of years. So I went to see him and wound up working at the SEC for 28 years.
Andy Barr was at that time the chief accountant of the SEC, is that right?
That is correct.
Who did you interview with besides Andy Barr when you came to talk to the SEC?
With Sid Orbach, who was chief accountant of the Division of Corporation Finance, and his assistant at that time, who I believe was Walter Michelson, or it was either Walter Michelson or Charlie Verhenny.
You started out in what division?
In the Division of Corporation Finance, in what they call as a branch accountant. At that time, the division had 12 branches and 12 accountants. I was the first second accountant in one of the branches.
So your branch was the first branch to have two accountants?
That's correct.
How long did you stay with the Corp Fin?
Approximately 10 years. I spent 5 years in the branch reviewing financial statements and then moved into the chief accountant's office, who by that time I think Walter Michelson was chief accountant, stayed there 5 years.
This was the chief accountant's office of the Division of Corporation Finance.
Correct.
Is that right?
That's correct. That would have made it 1969 when Andy's assistant retired and he was looking for a new assistant, and I wound up being selected for that.
So you became what then? Deputy or the associate?
Yes. I'm not sure what the title was.
Okay. What did you mostly do in those days as Andy's deputy?
Well, Andy told me he hired me to be his first sergeant to run the office and to do everything that needed to be done. So I guess I did some administrative stuff. But primarily, we looked at what I call appeal cases from Corp Fin, where companies didn't like the answers that Corp Fin had given them and asked us to take a look at it, and we would take a look at it and quite frequently wind up in conference with them to discuss the issue and reach decisions. We also were responsible for writing or approving whatever new rules, regulations, suggestions came from the divisions, and so some a good part of our time was spent doing that. And there was some external work as well, and I can't recall exactly what we did, but and Andy probably did most of it in that first year and a half or two that he was there, was speaking to groups and going to meet with financial groups.
So Andy was doing most of the public speaking kind of assignments back then?
I think so, although I'm sure he gave me some.
You actually served under two chief accountants, as I recall. Who's the second one?
Second one was Sandy Burton. When Andy retired, about 18 months after I went up to the office, I think, 18 or 30, I'm not sure which. He told me he had hired me to be the new chief accountant at the time, but our chairman at that time felt that he wanted to look outside for a chief accountant. I believe it was Casey, and he really wanted somebody to come in and do some things. He wanted to get somebody from outside, so he went out and found Sandy Burton.
When Sandy left,
by that time, Harold Williams was chairman, and he had ideas about looking outside for a chief accountant also. He told me his notion was that we should have a career person in the second spot to provide continuity and keep the SEC spirit, et cetera, in place, but to bring somebody in from the outside periodically to be the chief accountant. So he looked, and at that time, he didn't tell me this specifically, but I think he felt he was restricted from looking at public accounting people because of the conditions of the time. People were starting to get a little concerned about the accountants dominating the, that's not quite the right word, that accountants were too close to their clients perhaps, that's not quite right either. Anyway, he felt he couldn't look in the public accounting profession, so he looked primarily, I think, in the academic world. And the ones who were well qualified, frankly, were making too much money to come to the SEC. So ultimately, he didn't do a thing. He let me run the office, and I ran it, and we got along fine, and everybody acted as if I was a chief accountant until finally, although I'm not a person who pushes things generally, I went to Harold and told him it was time to do it and asked him to appoint me. And I asked him to appoint me on my birthday. Well, he did one of the two. He appointed me.
It wasn't far from your birthday, though.
No, it was the same month.
I think one of the projects that has some historical significance that maybe overlapped your period from being deputy into acting, maybe into the times when you were officially chief accountant, was the oil and gas accounting project.
Yes, it was.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it was an interesting experience for all people involved, I guess. The FASB had concluded that successful efforts was the only appropriate accounting method for oil and gas firms. At the time, there were two methods, the successful efforts and full cost accounting. And the full cost accountants, of course, were very unhappy. They were mostly smaller companies who spent a lot of money looking for oil and gas. And when they found it, they couldn't put the amount, the value of it on their books. They couldn't show any income. They couldn't show anything except that they'd spent some money. And when they didn't find it, they had to write it all off and showed big losses. And since most of the time you don't find it, would have all been showing big losses. And they were very unhappy about that, thought it would affect their stock market value. And so they raised a ruckus, and they got Congress interested, and they got into the act. And at one point, Congress had proposed to adopt a law requiring the GAO to set accounting standards. But neither the GAO nor the SEC liked that. So we got it changed, but the best we could do was that the SEC should do something about oil and gas accounting standards. So the temper of the times and the amount of political interest that have been stirred up. And let me say right here that the amount of political impact on the accounting profession was relatively low on the chief accountant's office and on the commission itself, but that didn't mean it was non-existent. It popped up from time to time, and this was one of those times. So we concluded that there was enough interest, we had to hold hearings. And we held hearings, held 10 days of hearings, 5 in Washington and 5 in Houston, which, of course, was a big center for oil and gas accounting. And at those hearings, the primary people who came to the hearings were small companies which were using full cost. And since full cost accounting itself was not in favor at that time, they didn't push on that real hard, but what they did do was stress at the hearings that it was important to show that the companies had a positive impact when they found some reserves. And so they pushed for recognition of reserve values. And I'm sitting there conducting the hearings, and I had all 5 commissioners there in D.C., and you could see them listening to this and nodding their heads, and, yep, this makes a lot of sense, this makes a lot of sense. And so we concluded ultimately that we should try to propose an accounting method which recognized values of reserves that have been found. It was dubbed reserve recognition accounting. The successful efforts companies, I think, were kind of sorry by the time we made this decision that they had not embraced the hearings. I think maybe they thought that the FASB had said successful efforts was the right thing, and that they didn't need to do anything, could sit back and wait for the SEC to say okay. But it didn't work. And we held hearings. We put out a proposal. We formed a committee and met for, I don't know what the time frame was, 18 months, 2 years perhaps. Ultimately, we concluded that oil and gas reserve values were significantly volatile, that maybe we shouldn't propose to actually have an accounting method based on that. And we deferred that, but we did say we could let people stay on successful efforts or full cost, but they had to have supplemental information showing a number called a, what did we call it, value of reserves, but it was recognized that we used a number which was the current value of reserves at the time you made the calculation. Of course, that changed, but then people would show that. Along the way, the relationships of the FASB and the SEC suffered a bit because we didn't tell the FASB what we were about to dump on them, to be frank, and say we weren't going to accept successful efforts accounting. At the time, I talked to my lawyers, and they told me the Freedom of Information Act prevented me from doing that. I'd be violating the law if I told them what we were about to do. So I didn't tell them. And afterwards, we made it through. Relationships were strained for a while, but they came back. I really concluded later on that this was one of those times when I should have said to hell with it and at least told him, you know, off the record that this was coming. But it didn't. We didn't.
That was the chairman of the FASB then was Don Kirk, wasn't it?
That's correct, yeah.
Did he express anything to you explicitly with respect to his unhappiness that they didn't know what was coming?
Well, we didn't have a spitting fight. And I can't recall any specific words, but obviously they weren't happy.
The 1970s was also an era was sometimes referred to as the Moss and Metcalf era.
Yeah, that's correct.
Congress was taking a lot of interest in oversight of the accounting profession.
Yeah.
Particularly Congressman Moss. What do you recall of that?
I would say particularly Congressman Moss, that's right. I don't... at the time, there was beginning to be concern about how good the accountants were at auditing companies and reporting on the financial statements of those companies. And Moss really thought maybe we should have some kind of public involvement in that governmental involvement in what was going on there and perhaps some kind of review of their practices. And I don't recall things specifically this late date, but there was at least a suggestion that there would be a law to set up something like what we now have today after this long period of time to have some public entity doing a review of accountants' practices. That didn't get off the ground, but the AICPA had formed a firms division, which didn't do a whole lot at that point in time, and some of the firms are just kind of ignoring it, I think. But the firms decided they should support that division, and they did set up some provisions for what people should be doing if they were doing public auditing. There was no peer review at that time, though. That was not started yet.
So it was kind of a lesser of two evils as far as the accounting firms were concerned. It's better to have a self-regulatory organization than have Congress do something for them.
Oh, I think that's very definitely the case, and that they really didn't do a whole lot at that time, but they did enough to at least get Moss to back off from trying to get a law enacted. Might not have been able to anyway, but they did do something.
They finally did institute a peer review program later on. What was the...
Yeah, they
what
did.
Was the chief accountant?
Mm-hmm. They did do that. As I remember it, it really started before Sandy got to the commission. We had an enforcement case. One of the Big 15 accounting firms had a client which had a lot of trouble, and when our people started looking at it, discovered some what we felt was inadequate auditing practices. And so the question was, what should we do? How do we satisfy ourselves that this firm is qualified to practice in the public arena? And so what we finally decided to do was ask them to give us a copy of their practices and procedures, And without deciding what we would do when we got there, we said, we'll look at it and then make up our minds. And so after several months, and my own conclusion was they didn't have a very good write-up of what they were doing in their practice, so they had to get it done and get it set up to the point that they would be happy having us look at it. We got it, we looked at it, and concluded that the most appropriate thing to do was to have another auditing firm take a look at it and see how they were applying it. And so we told them to do that, and they did. And that, as far as I'm concerned, was the start of peer review. It was a one-time thing, but it grew from there. And when Sandy got to the commission, as I recall, it was he who thought that we should set up a mandatory peer review. And at the beginning, we agreed that it could be handled by the AICPA Firms Division with SEC oversight. Which I will say that at the beginning, people were not too happy with our oversight. We wanted to look at things, and they didn't want us to look at things. And we kind of backed and filled, and we did what much as we thought we had to, and they allowed us to do as little as they thought they could get by with for several years as we worked on this peer review concept.
As I recall, one of the fights was over whether staff would have access to the peer review work papers.
Oh, absolutely. That was the big thing. They did not want us to look at peer review work papers. They wanted us to accept what they did. And I can't remember exactly what we got. We got access to some things, not as much as we would really like to have had, but we got enough to think that we were at least having an impact. And in anything like that, peer review, the most effective part of it is that the people who are going to be reviewed get prepared for it. And that's, in effect, what we did, too. They knew we were going to be looking at some things, and so they tried to make sure that what we looked at would be right.
Generally, I was, during your tenure there as chief accountant, well, how was the relationship with the AICPA, the American Institute of CPAs?
Well, I would say the relationship was pretty good. We worked together. We had people go to their auditing committee meetings, their accounting committee meetings to see what was going on. There was an SEC committee that they formed, which met with us to see what we were doing, to talk about things. And I would say that our relationship was pretty good. When the SEC felt something really needed to be done, they did it. And that was the most important thing.
Internally, what kind of relationship did the chief accountant's office have with the Division of Enforcement?
Oh, I would say our relationships with enforcement were pretty good. They didn't always initially agree with what we felt was the right thing to do. Enforcement people in general, and I mean, this is right, that's their job, is to look at things and take issue with them when there's a problem. And sometimes we thought they went a little too far in deciding that somebody had not done something they should have or had done something wrong. But by and large, we worked fairly well together. Never, let's see, when we went to the commission, as when we had enforcement cases that went to the commission, of course, both parties went there, and I can't remember specifically or any cases where we disagreed with enforcement. I think we usually worked out something which was a reasonable solution to the problems raised.
Yeah, I think that's true. One of the things that you stressed, in fact, I have a article that appeared in the internal SEC newsletter when you were appointed chief accountant, and you had mentioned it then, and it turned up in your speeches frequently after that, was the importance of the conceptual framework that the FASB was working on.
Yeah.
That a little bit?
Yeah, and that not because there was an obvious answer to what the conceptual framework ought to be, but if you looked at the history of the accounting and the attempts to set standards, they didn't have a benchmark, if you will, to resort to say, well, here's what we should be heading towards, and so therefore this is what the standard ought to be. And while I was never confident that we would get a good conceptual framework which would be as good as people would hope, i.e. provide answers when you had questions, I thought it was very important that we took a strong effort at it anyway. And so I supported it. We needed a base around which to set standards.
Were you happy, disappointed, or something in between with the final result in that regard?
No, I don't think we have a final result yet. we've been moving since ever I can remember towards some greater recognition of value in financial segments. And that's I think that's good. That's important. That's information investors ought to have. But the uncertainties of values and the fact that they will continue to be uncertain because the buyer and the seller determine the value, and often two different buyers and sellers get different values. It's going to take us a long time, if ever, to get to anything like fair value financial statements. But they're still moving towards that, and I think that's good progress.
The 1970s, in particular 1977, also brought us the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which, despite its name, contains some fairly substantial accounting-related.
Yeah, it did. As a matter of fact, that's an area where we had some differences with enforcement. There were some people in enforcement, fortunately, I think, far enough down the staff level that it didn't have too big of an impact, who thought that if you had a 10-cent error in the financial statements, that was a violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And obviously, since financial statements are all estimates anyway, and people do make mistakes, you can't say it's a violation of a law because you transcribe the number. So we had some discussions with some of the staff about that. But what the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act did do was force people to look at their accounting systems, to improve their systems, and to set up systems which would, at least if they were followed and people weren't going to sleep, would result in decent financial statements. And so although I was concerned that the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was perhaps literally too strong a step in the eyes of some people, it worked out pretty well.
Just to get off the technical areas for a minute or two, you served under, I think, at least four chairmen, maybe five if you count Fred Cook's 21 or 22-day tenure.
Yeah, probably at least five.
Tell me what you recall about each of the chairmen and your interactions with them.
Let's see, including my time as assistant chief accountant. Let me think. Casey was there when Andy left, and before Sandy came in, I was acting chief accountant for about 4 years. And Casey was gone when I was appointed, so it must have been early on. It must have been right after Andy left that he met with me and told me he expected to be there 5 years, and in 5 years' time, we should be able to solve all of the professions in the business world's accounting problems. And of course, you don't disagree with your chairman. I say, yes, sir. And although I must admit, I smiled inwardly to think we could solve all the problems in 5 years. I remember that very much. But perhaps even more important about, got to get sure I get my names right. Did I say Casey?
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't mean Casey. Casey was chairman who looked for Sandy Burton, so that's right. Good thing you're going to edit this some. It was not Casey. It was the gentleman from Wall Street.
Then it would have to be Williams, right?
No, in between Williams and Casey. So was it afterwards? Oh, it was after Williams. I'm getting my timeline mixed up, Ernie. The one I'm thinking about was after Williams, the guy from Wall Street. Yeah, Casey and I didn't have much of a relationship because it was a short period of time, and he really was looking for somebody.
You're thinking of Shad.
Shad, John Shad. He's the one I remember who wanted to solve all the problems in 5 years. And also, he felt that financial statements once published were sacrosanct. He was a financial analyst, and he said he relied on financial statements as they were prepared, and by God, they shouldn't be changed. It didn't matter whether there were errors or whatever. You put them in, found an error, you corrected it when you found it. And looking at summaries of earnings, which would be completely misleading unless you really delved into them and adjusted them, if you didn't correct for errors, that one was a bit unbelievable. Otherwise, Harold Williams was very interested in financial statements and results of them. And in that respect, a very good chairman from an accounting standpoint. And he did follow accounting quite closely when he was at the commission, and we worked together pretty well. He set up a lot of corporate governance things. And while they didn't directly affect accounting, it was something, of course, which had an... can't think of the right words for that. You can believe that. But he was good for the accountants at the commission in terms of being interested and understanding what was in the accounting profession. Let's see. We
he also took a lot of interest in the way the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was enforced, I think.
Oh, very much. And that was part of that corporate governance interest that he had. And he was interested in setting up the independent members of boards of directors and establishing audit committees. If I remember correctly, he was the one who really got the audit committee thing started.
And so some would say he was just 20 years ahead of his time.
Yeah, possibly, but somebody has to be 20 years ahead of time to get things done.
True. How about Chairman Breeden? What do you recall about him?
Chairman Breeden was not somebody I worked with a lot. He kind of left us alone mostly. And in general, although I appreciated Harold Williams' interest in accounting, it didn't seem to be too bad when the chairman didn't really want to get into accounting too much. Although I'll tell you one thing, I did appreciate having one commissioner on at a time who understood accounting. And it was generally somebody who took an interest and you could go and talk to and talk things out. Al Sumner was one of those.
Yeah, I think Al fell into that category when he was on the commission.
Mm-hmm.
How about Chairman Reuter?
I did not get to work with Reuter. I left, 6 months after he came on board? Sometime within a year, I think. And I was disappointed because my initial meetings with him led me to think that he would be interested in accounting and somebody good to work with. Of course, it turned out that things got so hot because of, what was it, insider trading?
You're fading that, Clarence. You have to...
Okay. I'm trying to think of what Reuter got embroiled in shortly after he became chairman.
Well, the crash of 87 was in his tenure.
Yeah, okay. That's what it was. And I just never got to work with him. He never had time to meet with me and talk about accounting at all. But he had sounded like a commissioner who would be a good man to work with.
To go back to sort of technical issues for a while, another thing that was high on the radar screen during the period of time that you were in the chief accountant's office was inflation accounting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this was one of Sandy's babies. He started the commission requirements in publishing information about inflation accounting, and it was a good time for it. He was there, he came in 82, I think, and we were going through a period of some significant inflation and got the board interested in it, but Sandy had his own ideas about things, and he felt strongly about this, and he set up his own system for reporting the effects of inflation with the commission as supplemental information.
I think you meant 72.
72? Yeah, you're right, 72. Mm-hmm. And it was a good thing to do. The board never, I'm tempted to say, adequately dealt with the subject, partially because inflation dropped off after, 3 years, 4 years, and people began to lose interest in having the information continue. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the things that John Shedd, I'm pretty sure it was, wanted to get rid of, was all of the inflation accounting disclosures. He didn't think they were worth a thing and wanted to get them out of there. And that's one of the things I thought that, not a major thing, but something I thought was important, that we should continue to have some kind of inflation information. He ultimately pressured me enough that the commission had to drop most of its disclosures, and the only thing I was able to retain was a kind of a general request that some kind of information be continued about inflation in the management's discussion and analysis. And it's still there, I think, and one of these days it'll be resurrected.
Well, as we move more towards fair value-based accounting models, there'll be less and less need for that.
Well, yeah, but what do you think the time frame is for a fair value-based accounting model?
Who knows? I probably will be long since retired.
I think we'll have an inflationary period again before we have a fair value model for formal financial statements.
Well, if we get another inflationary period like we had in 1980-81, it would be an impetus for something, probably.
That's right.
To digress a minute, you told a very interesting story about Chairman Williams and his cigar habit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've discovered in my middle, early 40s, I guess, that I'm allergic to cigarette smoke. And also organic mold, but cigarette smoke and organic mold are my two primary allergies. And as a result of that, my son, who must have been about, let's see, when was that? He must have been about an early teenager at that time, gave me a sign for my birthday that said, no smoking. And I thought to myself, by golly, if he thinks enough to give me a sign like that, I'm going to take it to the office and put it on the desk. And thereafter, people who were coming in to see me to get me to agree to something never smoke. But on one Saturday morning, we were in there working, and Harold walked in one morning. I was by myself, I guess. Yeah, I was by myself that day. He walked in to forgot what he wanted to talk about. But he walked in, and he looked at my sign, and he reached in his pocket and pulled out a cigar and lit it up. And what do you do? That's your boss. So I didn't say a thing.
Interesting story.
Yeah.
I think it was also during your tenure that one result of the Moss-Metcalf kind of hard look at the accounting profession was the evolution of the Treadway Commission.
Yes.
Why don't you talk about that a little bit, because I know that was something that interested the commission intently, and they used a lot of the commission's work.
Yeah, Jim Treadway was another commissioner who understood a lot about accounting and was a good man to talk to about accounting questions. And he had a strong interest in primarily in audit committees at internal controls. Well, fill me in, Ernie, a little bit. Refresh my memory.
It was after Jim Treadway ceased to be a commissioner. But
oh, that's right, yeah.
The official name was something like Committee on Financial Reporting Fraud or something.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right, and they got him to head that commission, and I guess primarily because, in my view anyway, because he understood about accounting and accountants. But, you know, I can't recall a lot about that commission.
They did some very interesting sort of diagnostic work looking at primarily SEC enforcement cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, my memory's not triggering on that. I don't know why.
Did you have much, I gather you didn't have much interaction with the commission or Jim Treadway during that period?
Not that much. As I recall, it was not primarily about accounting standards and as such, but more in the auditing and auditors and how you detect fraud. Therefore, for whatever reason, it doesn't trigger any recollections for me.
Many people would say one of the most important results from the Treadway Commission was the later development of the Committee of Sponsoring Organizations. Each of the organizations that sponsored the Treadway Commission developed a framework for internal accounting controls.
Well, yes, I would certainly say that was an important outcome. Mm-hmm.
And there was also, a movement at that time, and even some thought given to requiring management to report on internal accounting controls.
That came out of that. Huh? Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember anything about that initiative?
I remember how unhappy people were with having to report on internal accounting controls and the fact that accountants did not want to audit a company's internal accounting control system and report on it. Feeling, I guess, there would be too much potential liability associated with it. Yeah, there were some real struggles to get that kind of a requirement into place.
Well, I don't think it ever became a requirement in place until 20 years later when we had the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation.
My memory doesn't.
There was some voluntary reporting.
Yeah, there was a lot of voluntary reporting. That much I remember.
Financial Executive Institute developed a standard report, which many of the big companies were using until fairly recently.
Actually, the reporting that was done by accountants was really forced by the companies themselves. They wanted a report from their accountants, and by golly, they got it. Often that's the way things work.
You had a, during most of your period as chief accountant, and acting chief accountant, a fellow named Howard Hodges was chief accountant of the Division of Corporation Finance.
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm. Good man.
Howard was a well-known figure and something of a character. What were your relationships with Howard?
Oh, Howard and I had a good relationship. And he would, I started to say often, but he would sometimes take a position with a company that something he thought really ought to be done, but which he knew he would have trouble sustaining. But periodically he would take a position anyway on that and take a stand that this ought to be done. And they would come up, of course, and appeal, and frequently we would have to say, well, yeah, Howard, that's a good idea, but we can't insist on it. But every once in a while it was really, trying to think of the right word, funny and strange come to mind, but neither one of them is quite right. But we would be having a conference, and I would be listening to the company and listening to Howard and thinking to myself, you know, he's got a really good point. Maybe we should make them do this. And he was able to read me and say that I was going to agree with him, and he would subtly change his tone enough to let me know that, yeah, it would be the best thing to do, but you really shouldn't make them do it. And so we had a very good relationship. I was able to overrule him without interfering with our ability to get things done.
One of the things that I think has gone through, or at least some people would say has gone through a couple of evolutions, is the way the chief accounting officers and the Division of Corporation Finance deal with registrant questions and issues.
Mm-hmm.
What was the general tone, if you would, of dealing with questions that came up where there was no black and white answer?
Mm-hmm.
Starting back when you were working with Andy Barr.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it certainly is going through some changes over the years. Initially, we're accounting series releases, but there weren't a whole lot of them. The commission, however, would put out a release sometimes when they found a problem that they thought needed something done, and it needed to be done in a reasonable time frame. It would put out a release saying this situation happened and this is the way it should be done. But the staff, both in CorpFin and in the chief accountant's office, were pretty effective in getting things done informally by simply reacting to problems and questions and reaching conclusions, which the people involved would accept most of the time, even agree with, but sometimes just accept. And word got around by word of mouth. But as time went on, the people would argue that there should be accounting series releases, which spelled out all these things, or accounting practice bulletins, and I've forgotten the different names we had for them, but people wanted things in writing. They didn't like the idea that we could make decisions based on what we thought was right, and they didn't have anything in advance to know that we were going to do that. And so it got more formal as time went on. And we now have accounting series releases, and what's the name of the other series? We split them into accounting series and enforcement-related releases at some point in time. But the commission before I got there and after has always been, I think, a very important part of the accounting reporting process in the U.S. and its impact on the world as well, for that matter, in making sure people reach reasonable conclusions to reasonable questions, sometimes almost in spite of the written rules you might find. I remember one situation where you looked in the auditing literature and you found something that said that if you have an acquisition and you record all the assets, then the difference is goodwill. And, well, all right, you can argue that. You paid for it. It ought to be on the books in some fashion. And we had a case arise in which a company made an acquisition and they were recording it. In the process of recording it, and they discovered, by golly, that in a $300 million acquisition, $100 million of assets they thought they had didn't exist. And so the company trumped in with their auditors and said, hey, the rules say the difference between what we got and what we paid is goodwill. And I simply wasn't able to accept the fact that they should put a $100 million goodwill item on their books, which didn't exist. And we told them to write it off. And that's the kind of thing that the commission can say, look, that's just too far. You can't look at the written words and try to apply them to a situation where it just doesn't make sense. As a matter of fact, there's some language, and I'll bet you can tell me where it is, which says, if it doesn't make sense, you can't do it.
Maybe there's some legal language like that. at some point, that, I think, became more prevalent. That is, finding ways to get around the rules or use the rules in your favor rather than following them in a common sense kind of way.
Absolutely, no question about it. When I came and got in the accounting profession, which was 1959, I came to the SEC anyway. I traced my advent into the profession. Pretty much companies did what their auditors told them to do. The auditors looked at it and said, this is the way you should account for it. But even in 1959, as I got there, there were at least two conglomerate builders who were beginning to look at the rules and twist them to fit reporting assets and things to make them look better. And since that point in time, in my view, it got worse every year. And it built up all the way to the Enron and other cases more recently, which led to the Sarbanes-Oxley thing. Hopefully what comes out of that will make it better.
I think one of your former employers, as a matter of fact, Litton, is one of the first users of redeemable preferred stock.
That's one of the ones I had in mind. I remember that because I came to the commission with nice big ideas about what you should do and what you shouldn't do, and this stock that Litton created called a preferred stock was a common stock in disguise. The only difference was that the preferred stock got a preferred dividend. They shared earnings with a common. Everything else was the same. And not only could I not get that called a common stock in the financial statements, but the chief accountant of CorpFin at that time wouldn't even let me make them talk about it in the prospectus or in the I guess it was in the footnotes of the financial statements. My branch chief at the time, though, made them at least mention it in the discussion of business. And we didn't have anything called fully diluted earnings at that time. In my view, earnings per share was almost misleading with that stock outstanding. So they were one of them, yes. The other one was LTV that I remember specifically. Jimmy Ling.
Yes.
A man who I always tried to stay no more than two jumps behind.
One of the things that the chief accountant's office and the commission itself, I guess, as a whole, has traditionally not left to the private sector to deal with has been the independence rules for accountants.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. And again, accountants would like to have black and white rules in that area as well, but sometimes it's hard to write rules to fit all the situations. So the commission pretty much, at least for public auditors, had its own rules for accountants' independence, and we had to meet periodically and talk about them. But one of the ones I remember, and this goes back even prior to me, was the ownership of stock by auditors and their clients. And there used to be, as there is today again, a rule which said you could hold minor amounts of stock in your client. And I've forgotten the name of the case that Andy got involved in, which some auditor had a 1% interest in a client. And I don't remember all the facts, but that out of that grew the SEC position that you couldn't own one share of stock in a client. And that held for quite a while until finally, perhaps during my tenure, although I'm not certain, we agreed to relax that a little bit so that you could hold a immaterial amount. Let's see, you could hold an immaterial amount? I have to think back now. You know, it's been a long time.
Hold an immaterial amount if it was an indirect investment.
And if you weren't working on the audit.
Right.
Yeah.
But when did you finally leave the commission, and was it a retirement?
Yes, I retired at the end of '87. I'd reached retirement eligibility, and I had thought I will stay two or three more years in the commission probably. But then a vacancy opened up on the FASB in what we would call there was a joint slot, an analyst public in the governmental sense, governmental accountant seat. And frankly, I looked at the amount of money they were paying and thought it would be nicer to retire with more money. And so I retired from the they offered me the seat, and I retired from the commission and went there.
You spent, 5 years at the FASB?
It was a five-year term. Actually, it was 5.5 years because they changed the terms from December to June.
What was more fun, being the chief accountant or being a member of the FASC?
On a scale of 1 to 10, I'd say the SEC was a 9 and the board was a 1.
Why such a low ranking for the board?
Well, you used the word fun. Now, the board's job is important. Standard setting is very important. It takes a long time, however, and just not as much fun as sitting in a position where you have to reach decisions more than once a week about important accounting matters.
So it's really just a question of the lengthy process to try to accomplish it.
Well, two things. That, Ernie, is a big part of it. The other part of it is that when you're at the commission, you get problems and you reach a solution. It may not be perfect, but it's a solution that fits that situation anyway. And when you're standard setting, it's very hard to write a standard. And sometimes you can see where you want to get with a standard, and trying to get there within a conceptual framework, which we had at least, you know, we don't have a nice, deep conceptual framework, but the board has a conceptual framework. It was just very hard to get where you wanted to be. And when you had to do it over a period of 2 years, it just wasn't as much fun.
How much of that is the fact that, at least in the view of some, the board is much more sensitive to the influences of its so-called constituencies than the SEC ever was?
Much more might be too strong. The board is certainly sensitive to its constituencies, and the SEC is as well. As a matter of fact, one of the things I remember about Andy Barr is when we first started to get into bank accounting was, by today's standards, horrendous back in the 60s, I guess it was, early 60s, since Andy wasn't there very long in the 60s.
You say it was horrendous.
70s.
In what sense,
Mike? Horrendous? Bad debts were not an expense. They determined income before they took out the bad debt. And that makes it horrendous in my view anyway. And so the commission got into it, and let's see, I'm trying to remember now whether the commission or the accounting profession. The commission obviously was a big impetus, but I can't remember now who wrote the rules. I think it must have been the commission, making some corrections in bank financial statements. And we didn't do as much as I thought really was necessary. And I asked Andy Barr about it. And incidentally, when the commission considered this question, the chairman of the Federal Reserve came over and protested, dragging his feet all the way. But Andy told me, he said, look, there are sometimes when you can only do as much as you can do. And obviously it was political. And he did as much as he thought he could. And in my view, it was still not very good in terms of financial reporting. But that's as much as we could do at that time. And I remember that, and it's true. You need to make some steps, and you take as much as you can in one bite, and you let the rest go till the next time. Where were we?
And that's equally true in the private sector.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Mm-hmm. Whether it be the accounting profession or whether it even be companies, for that matter.
Toward the end of your tenure at the FASB, you received what I think is a very prestigious award from the SEC Companies Division of the AICPA.
Yes. Yes, that was very nice. The John J. McCloy Award. I appreciated that.
Mm-hmm. I think it was well-deserved.
Thank you very much.
Looking back over, I guess now close to 40 years, can you comment on how the SEC itself has changed and the way it does business has changed?
Well, of course, there are a lot of procedural changes and things. And the world has grown so much that the SEC had to change. You came in a little later than I did. When I came in, every registration statement went to the commission to be approved. And every 10-K, 8-K, 9-K were all examined. And over time, the commission simply couldn't devote the manpower to doing all that. And the staff has developed to the point where now an awful lot of registration statements are think probably still true, go effective without the commission ever looking at them. So administratively, there's been a lot of changes. When I came there, there was no, I was going to say no enforcement division. There, maybe there was one, but it wasn't active at all. And
it was called the Division of Trading and Markets then.
Yeah, so it wasn't really an enforcement division. And Corp Fin did their own enforcement actions. And that, of course, has changed tremendously. And it, I guess it had to. Stanley Sporkin era at the, in the enforcement division, where he used cases to make points, had a big impact on the community. So that was a big change. Thinking. I'm sure there are a lot of other things like that which don't jump right to mind. Accounting standard setting hasn't changed that much. The commission's chief accountant's relationship with the FASB changed from being one of, I won't even say cooperation at the beginning, of mutual acknowledgement of each other's existence and getting along with each other, to one of really full cooperation. The chief accountant went to all of the emergency issues task force meetings, and probably still does, and it was very important to be there. It's an interesting fact, which a lot of people probably don't know. You sit in that meeting, and my viewpoint anyway was, you don't say a word unless you need to. And time to time, you had to say something, and if you said something, they listened. And so it was a very cooperative relationship, and that has grown, and I assume that's still the same.
As far as I know, it is. The chief doesn't necessarily attend personally, but somebody can help.
Right. The commission's relationship with the board has evolved over time, too. The commission actually overturned at least two, maybe three board decisions. One had to do with the investment credit. One had to do, of course, with oil and gas. I think maybe there was one more. And that's why initially the relationship was one of cordiality, but not close relation, close working relationship, which it has now grown to, and which is really necessary to make the thing work right.
All right, I think I've exhausted my list of things to discuss. You got any closing remarks?
Oh, no, let's see. No, I enjoyed my time at the commission. It was a fascinating place to be at times, and that's why it was so much more fun to be there. A couple of other things I would say. I always thought that, I mean, it always had been true, but I always thought that the chief accountant should be someone who didn't like the power of the chief accountant's office. I think the power was necessary because at times you had to step in and make people do something that needed to be done. But if you enjoyed that, I think you could get way out of hand in terms of your impact on the financial reporting system. You had to be cautious. And one of my bywords to myself was, if I'm going to make them do this, will the commission back me up? And if you ask yourself questions like that, you can do an effective job. So I enjoyed my time. I'm glad I was there, and I'm glad that I had some impact.
I think you had a lot of impact, Clarence. Thank you very much.
Okay, Ernie.
Appreciate your time.
All right. Take care.